You're listening to CKMS 102.7 FM in Waterloo, Ontario, radiowaterloo.ca on the web. This program is a part of the Local Journalism Initiative Grant Program, and it's funded by the Community Radio Fund of Canada, the Government of Canada, and the CKMS Newsroom. You can access the recordings of this show on radiowaterloo.ca/news or on the National Local Journalism Initiative website. I'm your host, Ivan Angelovski. Last month, a group of small stock investors, members of a Reddit forum called Wall Street Bets, got organized and decided to stick it to the man. That's at least what this David versus Goliath narrative is all about. However, as usual, things are not so black and white. They're mostly gray, and that's what we're talking about today with David Simon, assistant professor of finance at Lazzaretti School of Business and Economics at Wilfrid Laurier University. Hopefully, after this show, things will be much clearer.
After the sort of pandemic starts to hit in 2020, and you know, if we go back to March last year, you had a large increase at that point in what we call retail investing. And when we talk about retail investing, we're talking about, you know, you, me, sort of what I guess American law would tend to call like a natural person sort of investing. We've really seen an increase in that over the past year. And people have assigned all sorts of motives to this. You know, they say people are bored at home, people have money sitting around that they otherwise would have spent on things like vacations. You know, there are a number of sort of theories that go into this. But, you know, sort of objectively speaking, we have seen more investing from retail investors like us. So that's the sort of start of this story. And where it sort of turns into the most recent phenomena is that a lot of these retail investors have sort of started relying on, you know, what you might think of as non-traditional sources of information for investing. You probably know as a reporter yourself that some publicly sourced information is very good. Some publicly sourced information is, you know, kind of dubious at the absolute best. What happened specifically with, you know, GameStop and BlackBerry and sort of these other companies around this time is that these were a group of companies which had what you would call a high short interest. Short interest refers to what you might think of as a short sale. Normally you buy a stock and then you sell it later. You hope it's at a higher price. A short sale is when you sell the stock first and then you buy it back later, hopefully at a lower price. And you know, you try and sort of do what you might think of as a normal trade backwards. You can't sell something you don't own. So normally what you do if you want to short sell a stock, if you're someone like, you know, you or me, we might go to our broker who, you know, actually does the trading for us, and we might borrow the stock from them, sell it. They're going to charge us a fee to sort of, you know, borrow the stock for a period of time, and then eventually we'll buy it back and give it back to them. If you're someone larger than us, like a large financial institution, or in this specific case, a hedge fund, you might also borrow it from a broker, but you might not borrow it from your broker. You might sort of go out on a more of a deal-making agreement to try and find someone who's willing to loan you a large amount of the stock, right? Because if you want to enter into a very large short position, one person might not just have it sitting around for you to borrow. You're going to have to go look for it.
So if I have all those stocks, why would I want to borrow you my stocks?
That's a very good question. So there are a few motivations for why you might want to lend me your stock in order to sell. For example, I'm going to pay you a fee the whole time. And, you know, all else equal, you probably like getting paid a fee. So that's a positive in your life. You might even think the stock price is still going to go up, in which case you have no sort of qualms about lending me a stock that I'm going to lose money on, because not only am I going to lose money on it, but I'm going to pay you fees the whole time. So that would be, you know, pretty good. The other situation you might be in is you might be in a situation where you have no sort of personal interest in the stock, even though you're holding it. you might be someone like a large fund manager who has to hold the stock as part of a well-diversified portfolio or something like that. You don't especially know whether it's going to go up or down, but it's a certain percentage in your portfolio, and you know, that's kind of a neutral decision for you.
What happens after I borrow you my stock?
Yeah, so you lend me your stock, I sell it, and I hope the price goes down. If the price doesn't go down, eventually you are going to get nervous about the fact that you have lent me stock. You know, I might have sold it for, you lent it to me and I sold it for $100 per share. You know that I have $100 because that's how much I sold it for. But if you look now and you see that it's gone up to, say, $200 per share, well, you better hope that I have more money on hand, right? Because I'm going to have to buy it back and it's going to be twice as expensive as before. And the process wherein you determine if I am likely to pay you back is what we call margining. You're going to perform a calculation where you're going to look at how much money I made from short selling stock versus the current price of the stock, and you're going to sort of judge whether it is likely that I'm going to pay you back. And eventually, if it becomes sufficiently unlikely that I'm not going to pay you back, if it looks like this is starting to get risky for you, the person who lent me the stock, you're going to give me what's called a margin call, which is basically a nice way of saying either finish your trade now and give me your stock back, or give me more money to show that you're going to pay me back eventually. What happened with GameStop and BlackBerry and others is a group of retail investors identified that there were lots of people who were short this stock. They identified that if the price of this stock went up a lot, these people would get margin calls. When these people got margin calls, they would subsequently have to buy the stock back, which would push the price of the stock up even more. And this is kind of a self-fulfilling cycle. And it's what we in finance call a short squeeze, where you short sell a stock, your margin runs low, you're sort of unlikely to pay it back. So you are forced to buy the stock back and give it back to whoever you lent it to, which pushes up the price even more, which forces more people to buy the stock back. And that's how sort of the cycle goes. And it happens very quickly. We can see with GameStop, it happened extremely quickly. You know, there were a couple days where the stock went from, you know, somewhere around like, you know, 10, 20, 40, and it rapidly became 400 overnight as sort of this short squeeze played out.
What's happening now?
Most people who short sold the stock close their positions. And it seems by sort of the publicly published statistics that the short interest in these stocks has gone very low from where it was before. And when that happens, you don't have as many people trying to buy the stock anymore. And, you know, the sort of cycle runs its course. And in sort of the last Friday is when it peaked, really, and it's Thursday now, and the stock has sort of lost, you know, somewhere between 75-80% of its value as this trade has sort of spun back the other way. You know, it's impossible to tell really where it's going from here, but that's sort of the situation that we can see today.
Are all those people lost their investment, or what happened with them?
So that's sort of a problem with not just short squeezes, but anything that we might sort of qualify as one of these, I guess, retail manias is what we might call them, where a lot of retail investors all try and do the same thing at the same time, and it pushes the price of something either very high or very low. So there were people who, you know, were holding the stock long term. If you bought the stock, you know, a couple years ago and it was, you know, $4 a share, life is still looking pretty good for you. But if you bought the stock, you know, last Friday and you bought it at $300, $400 a share, you're probably asking some questions today, because in the span of less than a week, that's just fallen apart completely. You know, their hope obviously would be that it goes back up. But the sort of situations that initially generated that have really changed. It's impossible to tell the future, but it's a tough game to be in if that's sort of the decision you made.
Yeah, but who are the winners and who are the losers here?
The winners, of course, anyone who was sort of holding one of these stocks before about a month ago is probably pretty looking pretty good right now. They definitely won. Even if they sold it right now, if you look at GameStop, for example, which is, you know, sort of the big example, last year, like, you know, around now last year, the stock was trading at $4 a share. So you might have missed out on $400 per share, but 58 is still pretty good. That's still a 10 times increase. If you were sort of a long-term investor in this, you're probably still quite high compared to where your buy-in was on something like GameStop. If you were someone who bought last Friday, you're the other side of this, right? You're probably pretty deep in the red. What's sort of gonna be difficult to disentangle are the other groups who are involved in this. You have groups like these retail brokers like Robinhood and others. They don't hold GameStop or things like that as their primary business. Their business is processing orders, and they've processed a lot of orders. It would appear that in the long run, that sort of thing is likely good for them. If you were short GameStop before last week, you probably took a loss on that.
We're talking about major traders, right?
Hedge funds, so there were a few large hedge funds that were kind of famously short GameStop, and we heard about their losses in the last week. There were other hedge funds though that were long-term investors in GameStop, and they made quite a bit of money last week. So I think one of the sort of narratives that has been very confusing is you often hear about hedge funds as sort of this nebulous mass of professional investors. They usually have a sort of villain tag associated with them. Really, these are very different companies with very different motivations. Just because they have the label hedge fund does not mean they are all doing the same thing in any way. Even among them, there are winners and there are losers here. I think it's a complicated narrative in my point of view.
One big chunk of problem is a lot of regular people who were trying to get on board when the things got crazy, who probably lost a lot. How do you explain to them that they shouldn't do that ever?
If I had the way to explain to them that they shouldn't do that ever, you know, I would be, I think, a lot more successful than I am right now. But this is not a new problem, unfortunately. We can go back into sort of the history of everyday people getting caught up in whether it's like investment manias, whether it's gold rushes, these are all sort of the same fundamental human desire that we see, right? We turn on the news, we see that someone who seems to be a normal person made a mountain of money investing in some stock, and we think to ourselves, it's a hard human impulse to ignore, right? We sort of see this again and again, and regulators, like in Ontario, we have the Ontario Securities Commission. They spend a lot of time trying to do like investor education and things like that. And unfortunately, you know, I can't speak ill of their efforts, but this is a human impulse that they're sort of trying to push against. And it's a very hard human impulse to push against. There's something in what we call behavioral finance. Behavioral finance is sort of studying how the human animal interacts with financial markets. And what we say is that humans are excellent at pattern recognition. It's one of our best skills. And it's great to be, you know, good at pattern recognition if you're in the wilderness and you're trying to figure out whether a bush is a bush or whether a bush has a tiger hiding in it, because, you know, one of those is going to end very poorly for you. So this, you know, it's good that we have pattern recognition. Unfortunately, when we apply that to finance, people tend to see patterns where either they don't exist or where they want to believe they exist. Because of that, it sort of feeds into this, right? It's a natural human impulse. It's a tough one to ignore because, again, we're wired to find that tiger in the bush. Sometimes you look at the numbers on the screen and damn, does it ever look like a pattern.
This is CKMS and you're listening to our interview with David Simon, assistant professor of finance at Wilfrid Laurier University, about the phenomenon of Reddit investors and whether the whole thing with the GameStop and BlackBerry in the last few weeks means that people should or shouldn't think about investing.
One thing that has been very, very good for you know, sort of normal investors is that the world has changed a lot over the past 20 years. If we look back to how the world was, you know, 1990s, 1980s. And if you were a normal investor, you wanted to invest, you probably had to call up your bank or you had to call up your investment advisor, and they might charge you as much as $100 for the privilege of investing in something. That's kind of come and gone at this point, right? We have all these online platforms where it is much easier for people to get involved. And because of that, you see people sort of getting involved in investing who weren't before, which, you know, in general, we tend to think that people should save. Investing is a good way of saving. And so this is sort of a net good. The other, in my opinion, at least, sort of real benefit that normal investors like you and I have seen over the past few years is the rise of these exchange traded funds. These were, you know, pre-2000s, very rare, not very available. But now we can pay fees of 0.2% a year to invest in something that tracks just an index. And as sort of a fun statistic, if you take a look at, there's an index called the Barclays Hedge Fund Index. It tracks the average return of hedge funds every year. If you compare that to just the S&P 500, over the past 4 years, depending on the year, the S&P 500 has outperformed the hedge fund index by around 4 to 10% a year. And that's a strategy that like you and I can engage in, compared to sort of this like big institutional money. So it's really a time when retail investing has more options than it has before. The other side of this is that because retail investing has more options than it has before, there are fewer guardrails in place. There are fewer forces to tell people what a bad idea is or what they might want to reconsider. Because of that, we sometimes see the other side of it. It's not a good thing. You don't want normal people losing 75% of their money, their investment in a week. That's not something that really benefits anyone. Even if you profit off of it, it sort of harms confidence in the financial system in general, which if you're involved in the financial system every day is not a good thing for you. It's a tough trade-off when you're looking at sort of how people are able to act these days.
What do you think now of Robinhood and Wealthsimple, and was this the dark side of that?
I think it's tough to think of it in a very black and white. On one hand, the sort of what we would call, I guess, discount brokers, because that's sort of traditionally what we would call people like Robinhood, people like Wealthsimple, these online brokers that are very low or no fees. They have brought investing to groups of people who just didn't have it before. And if these people sort of, you know, act in a deliberate, responsible manner, that is a net gain at the end of the day. Where criticisms have come of these brokers, I'm not sure if you're familiar with this term, but gamification. Gamification is sort of a bit of a buzzword these days, and it means putting together usually something like a computer application, you know, like a mobile app that resembles the same payoffs that you would get emotionally from something like a video game. You log onto the app, you buy a stock, it tells you good job, it shows you, you know, fireworks, and you get that little serotonin hit that you've done a good thing. There has been criticism of some of these low-cost brokers that they are gamifying investing by sort of encouraging people to make more trades, to do more things.
How do you explain the fact that they stopped, that Robinhood like stopped trading on GameStop at one point? What's the financial explanation of that?
What sort of a lot of people, you know, for good reason, don't know about financial markets is that if I log on to my computer terminal right now, you know, I open up my broker and I buy 100 shares, enter, and it says trade completed, you bought 100 shares. I actually don't own those shares for another 2 days. In financial markets, or at least in equity financial markets, we have what's called T+2 settlement, which means that between the time I agree to the trade on the computer screen and the time that I actually get the stock is 2 days later. There are a lot of good reasons why a system like this is in place. For one, it means that I am able to buy and sell in the same day without actually getting the stock and then giving it to someone else. It sort of logistically makes it easier. The other thing that it makes much easier is dealing with multiple counterparties. So I might trade with you and I might trade with someone else. If I bought from you and sold to someone else, I would have to go, I need to get the stock from you, I'd have to go give it to someone else. What's much easier is if we have a central body that sort of, you know, adds up all our trades and comes up with the net sort of, you know, here's who gets money, here's who gets shares. And that sort of makes life easier. How this relates to Robinhood, in the 2 days between when you agree to a trade and when the trade actually goes through, the price of the stock changes. As the price of the stock changes, the clearinghouse, which is the sort of entity that aggregates all of these trades, is itself judging how likely it is to get the cash and shares from everyone involved. Now, if you look at someone like, for example, Robinhood or any of the other sort of retail brokers, they had a lot of people buying GameStop, but they didn't have a lot of people selling GameStop. From the clearinghouse's point of view, it looks at Robinhood's orders and it says, you are going to need a lot of money and we are going to give you a lot of shares. We want to make sure that you actually have all of that money that you say you do, because when you agreed to those trades yesterday, the price of the stock might have been $100, but today it's $400. So we just like to make sure of this. So they asked Robinhood and other retail brokers for more margin. Unfortunately, a lot of these sort of free retail brokers didn't have mountains of cash sitting around to just deposit at these clearinghouses. And they can't just politely ask their clients to stop buying things because it's hurting their margin requirements. You know, not a lot of people are going to sort of agree to that. So this was sort of the genesis why they decided to shut down buying in these stocks, because it was becoming sort of prohibitively expensive for them to deal with their clearer.
But we saw a lot of rage against Robinhood.
If we go back historically, this isn't kind of the first time that people have been mad about limits on trading. You can go way, 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 way back to 1987. There's a day in 1987 called Black Monday, and it's one of the largest single day global stock losses ever.
What happened then?
In 1987, world markets, depending on sort of what country you're looking at, had a 1 day loss, like not just one stock, but over the whole market of, you know, 25, 30, 40% all in 1 day. And a sort of urban legend that comes out of this is that the stock losses were so bad that allegedly the brokers who were actually doing the trades just disconnected their phones. They were tired of hearing sell orders. They just pulled the cord out of the wall. No more sell orders because the phone's not connected anymore. And the fact that we still have this story, you know, 34 years later, sort of illustrates the kind of upsetness that can happen around this, right? So I'm not surprised that people would be upset about this. I think it's probably going to disappoint people that it's a most likely a very mundane explanation, but you know, that's kind of how it goes sometimes.
However, do you see this happening anytime soon again?
Sort of retail investment manias are they're an old thing. You haven't really had this. I don't want to call it deliberate internet coordination behind it before, but we have had retail-based bubbles in investing before. This isn't the first time. I would be shocked if it was the last time. This is, as I sort of said before, it's a human impulse to, you know, we're social animals. You see other people doing things and you see them doing well and you see that it's a good idea and you want to go along with the rest of the pack. I think social media has sort of played a big role here, right? One thing we know about social media from, you know, not just investing, but like just in general, is that people like to post success on social media. You know, you post your vacation pictures where you're looking good, post your I got promoted at work. You don't post your I was walking down the street and I dropped my takeout food all over the place and my day feels kind of crappy photos. So when people apply this to investing, you see people making a lot of money. You see people making successful decisions. Sometimes you see the bad ones, but those aren't the ones that we hear about all day.
But what would you suggest to, you know, regular people? Should we start investing? If we do, should we go with traditional traders, or should we go with Robinhood and Wealthsimple and those kinds of?
I'm never going to recommend, you know, buying one thing or another thing, but I think who you actually choose as your broker at the end of the day is kind of less important than the actual decisions you make based on that. You can use Wealthsimple, you can use Robinhood, and you can use them for a very responsible type of investing. There's no reason you cannot use Robinhood in sort of a traditional value-based investing sort of strategy. It's just that in the past little bit, they've sort of become associated in the popular sort of mindset with this sort of retail mania, right? There's no reason that someone using Robinhood has to act inherently differently than someone using a large bank or something like that. In terms of investment styles, I mean, there's no right answer to that, obviously, but there is mountains of sort of well-documented, verifiable public information on investments. You know, people like the Ontario Securities Commission do investor education. A lot of, you know, large financial advisors and banks do financial education. And this is sort of a more prudent way of going about it than watching a video on Twitter that tells you to go out and buy a particular stock.
Yeah, but, you know, with people not trusting big banks and you know, governments,
it's an understandable problem. There is, you know, one of the things I think that has kind of come out over the past, I'd say 4 years especially, is a lack of confidence in public institutions. As a reporter, you're probably particularly sensitive to that, right? The press has experienced low trust.
It is distrust in institution in every way. So.
Mm-hmm. And institutional distrust in this sense sort of opens up a span for sort of, you know, I'm not going to say everyone who's providing investment advice on Twitter is, you know, a bad person looking out for their own interests. But if you were a bad person looking out for your own interests, that's a great sort of opening to try and get into, right? There are good people who are just trying to, you know, share their views, but there are also very self-interested people who are trying to, you know, either increase their personal following, make their own investments do better, things like that. And, you know, humans have a limited capacity for attention. And if you find yourself in the wrong sort of group of commentary, it can seem like there's a really right decision to make, but you're kind of stuck in an echo chamber. It's a trap that can be easy to fall into.
Yeah, never a good place to be in.
No, and you know, we all have our sort of bubbles, right? We all have people who are similar to us who we listen to more often because, you know, people with like views tend to congregate. It's fine when I think that the Montreal Canadiens are the best hockey team because I only talk to other Montreal Canadiens fans. That's harmless, right? If I'm using that to kind of invest my life savings, that's where you really start worrying.
You've been listening to the CKMS Newsroom at 102.7 FM and our interview with David Simon, Assistant Professor of Finance at Wilfrid Laurier University, Lazaridis School of Business and Economics, about GameStop, BlackBerry, Robinhood, Reddit, Short Squeeze and all those financial terms that entered our lives in the last few weeks. If you didn't understand anything, you can check out the archived versions of this program and other episodes on radioworld.ca/news. You can follow us on Twitter at radioworld. And you can email news@radioworld.ca to get in touch with comments or ideas about stories to cover. The music was Black Room by Moby, thanks to MobyGratis.com. My name is Ivan Angelovsky, and I was your host for this program.